Hey, folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. Our guest is Andrew Reich. He is the director of a new documentary called Born Innocent, The Red Cross Story. You can go to redcrossfilm.com for information. It is playing at WFMU's performance space called Monty Hall on December 22nd. I think it might sell out. I don't know. It's kind of a weird day. Maybe you're Christmas shopping or maybe you're dying to go out. So if you want to go see it, buy a ticket in advance. That's my advice. It's a, you know, this used to be a real estate office. When we bought the building that WFMU is now in, there was a thriving real estate office there that was less thriving over the years, and we ended up turning it into a performance space. So it's a fun place to see an event, and of course, any money that we make or don't make goes to help the radio station. So I really love this band, Red Cross, especially as a live band. They're just sort of a killer live band, and they're just interesting guys. One of the themes we talk about in this interview, I think we're both really on the same page, is that this is a kind of a movie that really will appeal to anybody who's interested in people or music. It does not necessarily have to be people who are predisposed Red Cross fans. So when it eventually streams, I'm sure this movie will eventually stream, but there's no deal for it yet. But when it does, watch it. I think you'll enjoy it. Or there's a whole list of places where it's going to be playing from now through the beginning of next year. So check that website, redcrossfilm.com, for information. And, you know, hope you enjoy this. Hope your holidays are good. Be in touch. I'm Michael S. at WFMU.org if you've got questions, comments, concerns, Christmas gifts. That's where to find me. Enjoy this. It's me and Andrew Reich. There is Red Cross, and joining us on the phone is Andrew Reich, the director of Born Innocent, The Red Cross Story. Good morning, Andrew, and welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's so cool to be here. I grew up listening to WFMU, so this is a thrill.
Yeah, a New Jersey native. Congratulations. This movie just opened in theaters. It's coming to Monty Hall December 22nd, as I mentioned earlier. I really loved it. I mean, I love this band. I lived in L.A. for a little while in the late 80s and saw this band many, many times at that point, and they never failed to kill me. Like, just great live band. And I think this, what makes this movie sort of can't miss, is that Jeff and Steve McDonald are two super duper interesting guys. Even if you never heard a note of their music, the story is interesting, and they're just kind of interesting guys. So let's talk about those two guys before Red Cross starts. Did they have a normal childhood?
I think they really did. I mean, a normal Southern California childhood. I don't know if that, I don't know what counts as normal. But yeah, they were grown up in Hawthorne in the South Bay area of, you know, outside of L.A. in the 70s. And they were skateboarding and riding their bikes around and going to the beach. And I think Jeff, musically, Jeff's the older brother, and he was quite precocious in terms of his ability to find cool music. I mean, I think they started out, they were into Kiss, they were into Led Zeppelin, they saw Rod Stewart and the Faces, I think, at the Forum. They, you know, they were seeing that sort of arena rock, you know, and then they were into Alice Cooper, and then Jeff was sort of finding David Bowie, which at that point in that very conformist town was pretty radical. He said, you know, buying a Bowie record at the record store, that they would look at you like you were buying porn or something. And then he heard a Patti Smith song on the radio, Free Money, and didn't hear it back announced who it was, but somehow was in a record store and saw the cover of Horses and was like, this must be that girl who sang that song. And he's finding this stuff with no help from anyone. So I think once that happened, and then they, you know, discovered the Ramones, they've been huge Beatles fans growing up, then their childhood got a little bit less normal. I mean, because at the point they're sort of becoming punks, like there were very few. Mm. But I do think starting out, it was a pretty, you know, suburban, you know, so they tell the story, it's not in the movie, but Jeff broke his arm skateboarding, and that kind of shifted them from skateboarding to music. But they were those SoCal kids.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the Ramones and the Beatles, because that's, I think they say that in the movie. And to me, that's like perfect distillation of what Red Cross is in a way. So the film's very funny, and there's times when the two brothers sort of devolve into their, you know, you have them on a couch talking, and they sort of devolve into being two little kids again, kind of like, you know, wanting to punch their brother in the arm or whatever, you know. There is a point, I think it's one of them, Steve says, that they got into, quote, psychotic garbage culture, which is sort of like their take on this sort of absurdness of 70s, you know, H.R. Puffin stuff and Paul Lynn Christmas specials and the Partridge Family, stuff like that. I think that really is like a super 90-degree turn for those boys, how they reacted to that sort of over-the-top 70s. Yes, and they formed the band in 1978 when they're, what, 12 and 17? Is that right?
I think they were 11 and 15 when they started the band. Yeah, I mean, I think they, you know, they grew up watching all the Brady Bunch and Partridge Family and Room 222 and H.R. Puffin stuff and all that stuff. They were sort of, you know, the typical kids at the time where they would just come home and just watch tons of TV. Their parents worked. And then I think they're part of this first wave of Southern California hardcore. The first time they play in front of anybody is in front of Black Flag, who they had tracked down, and they went to their rehearsal space and sort of auditioned to be their friends and started opening for them, you know, in some of the earliest Black Flag shows. And then, you know, so they're part of that wave, and Greg Hepson goes on to form the Circle Jerks, and Ron Reyes, their drummer, becomes a singer of Black Flag. But they very quickly, Jeff really especially, just got so disillusioned with what that scene became once all these sort of surfers from Orange County started getting into it, and the sort of jocks who used to beat them up and call them Devo and whatever started to like coming to shows. And they wanted to get away from that. And I think at that point, you know, Jeff really just embraced. A lot of people, once they became punks, just, you know, it's a sort of year zero mentality where everything that came before that you might have liked has to be thrown out. And they're just like, no, like, we really like the Partridge Family. Like, we think this is good music. We still love the Beatles. We still love when there's a song on Bewitched, or there's like the Honeybees on Gilligan's Island. Like, these are, you know, these songs which are being written by Boyce and Hart and these great songwriters. They're like, this is good music and we like it. And we're not going to really apologize for that. And that's when they start to bring that in to their music kind of unapologetically. I think a little bit was as a way to just sort of, you know, antagonize, piss off the punks. Like, everyone's trying to be so hard. Like, we're going to talk about the Partridge Family, you know, because that's just so the opposite of this sort of macho culture that's emerging that they hated. You know, I don't think any of that stuff with them was ironic or parody. It's things they genuinely loved. And, you know, when Jeff in the movie holds up the Sound magazine album by the Partridge Family and he says, I think side two is up there with Pet Sounds, he's not really saying that. To me, it's really funny, but he's not saying it to be funny. He means that to his core. And I think they're pranksters, and they were huge John Waters fans, and John Waters is such a huge influence on a lot of the stuff they do, but they really wanted to just meld together all the stuff they loved, and that included Kiss, as well as the Ramones, as well as whatever, the Avengers, Germs. They're fans of all of these things, and they wanted to really mash it up and take it seriously. You know, none of this is done from some ironic distance of like looking down on these, you know, TV shows that people thought were junk.
Yeah. I think too many documentaries now are sort of made by people who are maybe too close to the band, too many music documentaries. I mean, I never thought I'd say this. There are too many music documentaries, but I sort of think there are at this point. And I like that you didn't shy away from some of the tougher topics, including this sort of bombshell. Steve, who you said joined the band when he's 11, I think this is probably when he's 12 or so. And this is a long story short, and I'll just keep it short so that folks will go watch the movie. But he's dating this 24-year-old lady, Dee, and I think someone says in the film that it was pretty common for people in their 20s to date 11 and 12-year-old boys, which is just, I don't quite
understand. Well, I think they, you know, they're not 11 or 12, but much, you know, I mean, maybe Jennifer Finch, she says that, you know, like 13, 14, I think she's saying like 13, 14, 15, Yeah, I mean, I think it was, and I think what she's saying is not that it was common, you know, so common for older women to be dating boys that age, but it was common for men to be dating girls that age. That was what was fairly common in that scene, which isn't really talked about. I think there are a lot of revelations that have come out about people in that scene and, you know, being, you know, as the pedophiles, we would call them today. But I think back then it was sort of not considered that unusual. Oh, so-and-so is dating this 14-year-old girl. And like, you know, that just seems normal, even though they're 25, 26, whatever it is. It was less common in the other direction.
Oh, that's so interesting, because that's not what I got from the film at all. I sort of took it that she was saying girls were dating boys. Yeah, we all know about Kim Fowley and Rodney and those people and that sort of icky part of the scene. Well, it sort of culminates that she kidnaps him, and he's gone for 3 months at age 12, and they end up finding him in Las Vegas. I mean, it's just such a bizarre... Was that a secret? Was that a known thing? Because I'd never heard that.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, because I didn't know, as a Red Cross fan since, you know, 1984 or whatever, I didn't know it until about, I guess, 9 years ago now. I heard Steve McDonald tell that story on the Punk podcast that Damian Abraham does, and it was really the spark that made me want to make this documentary, because I'd always been fascinated by Red Cross and thought they would be a great subject, you know, for so many reasons. But then I heard him tell that story and it was just like, oh my God. And then there's this, like, someone's got to make this movie. At which point, you know, I was telling that to my wife and she said, well, maybe you should do it. And, you know, here we are 9 years later. But it wasn't a total secret. Very few people in the, you know, he didn't talk about it a lot. There was a story that someone wrote in Maximum Rock and Roll that had told the story, you know, well after the fact, not at the time. And Steve, you know, he would tell people here and there, but I haven't encountered a ton of people who know the story. So yeah, it was, it's not like it came up, you know, as a surprise while I had started making the movie. It was one of the sparks for it. And also one of the biggest challenges in editing terms of the film, because as you were saying, and this really, you know, I should say, it really is the Jeff and Stephen McDonald story. Like, it's really about these brothers, and it's why I think the movie is accessible to people who've never heard a note of Red Cross. It's this incredible story of these brothers who became business partners at age 11 and 15 and still are 45 years later, and just what that means. And because they are such smart, funny, interesting, charismatic people, you are watching this sort of, you know, sibling love story, love, hate, love story. But it's fun. They're funny. And because they're so young, there's humor in that. And then there's this very dark thing that happens, because the story of Steve and Dee is dark. And it's kind of like in the movies, it's like, okay, how do we, you know, this, where this falls in the movie is kind of, you know, like 20 minutes or so in, and how do we get into it and get back out of it, you know, and get people to keep having fun. And it was a real challenge. I think, you know, having seen it with a lot of audiences, I think we pulled it off. But I do think it is something that gives the movie, that makes it a little bit different from just your run-of-the-mill, like, here's a story of a band, because there's this heavy thing that happens. And then I think I leave it sort of up to the viewer to sort of look for, like, how did this affect them going forward? Like, how did it inform things? They're not very explicit about that, but it's, you know, it's such a traumatic event, and I have my theories that I don't, like, hit anyone over the head with in the movie, but it's just like, you know, what does something like that happening mean for the rest of the history of this band?
The event is so bizarre that they recall it, you know, almost like a third, it happened to someone else. So let's move on. One interesting thing about the story is that as it evolves over 45 years, so does, you know, the focus of popular music, so does the band's sound, and the sort of juxtaposition of those two things I think is very interesting. And as they get better musically and as their ideas change and grow, and I think also to some extent as they're sort of chasing success and as they're influenced by record labels and what they want, there's a lot of push and pull, and you do see them go from, you know, 11 28-year-old punks that can, in some cases, barely play to, you know, this kind of glammy thing, a little bit of retro thing, into trying to fold their pop thing into it and trying to figure out what Red Cross is. And I found that part of the movie super interesting.
Yeah, I do too. You know, it's why, you know, this band has continuously interested me for all this time, because they change and evolve so much, and they're just always sort of like following their muse wherever it takes them. And it's another part of their dynamic, which is interesting, because, you know, there's the easy, you know, sort of hook for this movie is like the band that should have been huge that never made it. And let's like try and analyze like why they never made it big. And, you know, there's some interest there, but, you know, in talking to the two of them, when I would sort of press them on those things, you see like Steve's, he took some of that hard. Like, he was bothered by when peers, you know, groups that they considered peers, whether that was Guns N' Roses or you know, early on, whether that was the Circle Jerks or Guns N' Roses or Jane's Addiction or, you know, any other sort of L.A. band that sort of, like, made it big, there's a part of Steve that's just like, why, that should be us. Like, why is this band getting so big? Jeff, on the other hand, and I asked him about this many times, so I believe it's true, does not care. He never cared, and he was never going to do anything for the purposes of like being more quote unquote commercial. Like, he's just temperamentally immune to doing that. Like, he couldn't do it if he tried. So some people, you know, sort of look at this, was there self-sabotage, you know, choices they made, that, you know, they get this major label deal in the late 80s, you know, just as a sort of, you know, kind of grunge thing is bubbling up that they've really helped instigate. But, you know, all the Seattle bands that became that movement just loved them and looked up to them and loved this way that they had of mixing like melody and heaviness. And instead, they don't make a record that sounds anything like that. They make this sort of bubblegum record because Jeff was really listening to like 1910 Fruit Gum Company at the time, and that was what he was into. It's yeah. Just like, you know, you could say that's self-sabotage, but it's not. It's just like, that's what he was into, and that was what he was going to do.
Right, but then you can't be surprised later when, you know, didn't our record sell as much as Nirvana at a time when it, you know, right. And to me, that's such like a modern trope of these kind of movies, is that, like, you know, every band sort of says, oh, you know, we influenced all these people. And, you know, to me, rock and roll is just a continuum. You know, it just organically grows. And so if you're in that chain, of course, you're going to take influence from people and give it to people, no matter where you are on the chain. And, you know, I think there's very few bands who really, really have a real claim to, you know, I got my thing got ripped off. And, you know, people take stuff and commercialize it. It's just kind of how it works for me.
You know, I don't think there's a lot of bitterness there, really. And I think that they're able to see the upside of never having had that kind of household name fame, which is so hard on people's lives and often ends badly. And these guys have been able to have great family lives and be just sort of well-adjusted adults who are, you know, still right now, like, have an amazing album out and are out touring Europe, and they don't have the fate of, like, being a one-hit wonder, kind of, like, where they just have to go. People just want to hear that one song from them. You know, you go to a Red Cross show and people are shouting out, like, 30 different songs with not a lot of overlap, because everyone's got their favorite period or their favorite song, and it's not just like, oh, we got it. Everyone's just waiting for us to do this, and then they're going to go home. Like, there's none of that. And I see a little bit, like, oh, you know, and there's some moments in the movie where, there's a Stone Temple Pilots song that me and many other people, when we heard it on the radio, were like, oh my God, they're playing Red Cross. And then it's like, what? It's what? It bothers me. It doesn't bother those guys. They get, like, no, people, like, we toured with them. They were fans. They had a song that kind of sounds like us, but it's their song. And, like, you know, that's sort of my attitude. It's really not theirs.
Well, to me, I look at it not like this is a band who didn't get their due. I look at it completely the opposite. These are like two bizarro, super talented people who got really lucky that so many record labels spent fortunes on them trying to connect, you know, their artistry with the mainstream, which, you know, didn't happen. But of course it didn't happen. Like, you know, these guys are doing something that's completely out of left field. One of the things you do is you talk to many former members in the of the band. I think there's 12 drummers in the band. You talk to a lot of people in the band. How many former members were there? How many did you talk to? And they all seem to really enjoy their time. That was like one thing in common. Everybody, they all just had a great time in that band.
Yeah, I think that's true. I can't offhand tell you how many I talked. Yeah, I tried to talk to as many as I could. I missed some people that were in the band for very, very brief moments. I do think everyone did. You know, everyone had fun. Like, it's probably not as rosy as these recollections, and like, I wasn't digging for the dirt, but like, they had so many different, you know, very distinct phases, and you know, and I happen to love all of them. There are people that are like, oh, that Neurotica lineup with Robert and Roy, like that's the real Red Cross, or, you know, or older people from LA were just like, oh, when Janet and Tracy were in the, but it's just like all these lineups made really cool music and had great shows, and the personalities of those, you know, drummers and guitarists as they came and went, like, certainly affected the band, but it was always Jeff and Steve's. You know, they were always the guiding forces of this. And I really tried, you know, all along as I was, you know, making the sort of painful cuts you have to make, because I really, you know, as you were saying, there's probably too many music documentaries out there. There's definitely too many really long music documentaries out there. And I was just like, I'm going to keep this under 90 minutes. But I was always just like, is this important to the story of Jeff and Steve? That was really my guiding light. But it was really fun talking to all. I mean, and I have so many drummers, but I didn't get them. There's others that I didn't get in there. There are still a few.
Let me remind folks that Andrew Reich is our guest, and he's the director of Born Innocent, The Red Cross Story. It's just opened in theaters, and if you go to redcrossfilm.com, you can find information about where it's playing near you. It will be streaming eventually on that site and probably elsewhere. And, of course, it's coming to WFMU's Monty Hall Sunday, December 22nd, just in time for Christmas. So just quickly, how many minutes of Talking Head film do you shoot for how many end up in the movie?
Oh my gosh, it's another thing where I'm not going to be able to come up with a number because I haven't
just a ballpark.
But it's, you know, it's hundreds of hours of interview footage. I mean, there's so much. I mean, there was so much with the brothers themselves. I forget how many times I had them sit down and we spent hours interviewing them. And then, you know, again, I don't have a number of how many other people I interviewed, but so many, there's lots of interviews I did that, none of that got into the film. Cause again, just sort of ruthlessly trying to like keep it fast paced and entertaining all the way through and not go down too many rabbit holes and not put anything in that's just for the hardcore fans. My guiding light was like, I just want this movie, you know, obviously I want it to work for the fans, but I want it to work for someone who's just never heard of them and is coming to it totally fresh, who's maybe just like a fan of some of the other bands where I have, you know, people that are Talking Heads or, you know, who knows. And it's been rewarding. The most rewarding comments I get are from the people who are like, I'd never heard of this band. I didn't know anything about them, but I loved it. I love these two guys. And
yeah, I totally think you succeeded on that part. To people who never heard of the band, you know, still super, you transcended just talking about, you know, the history of Red Cross. So another thing I'm super glad you addressed is drugs. Total tough topic. And, you know, you watch the Beatles anthology, and they don't mention drugs hardly at all, you know, it's just ridiculous. They talk about taking acid. And I think this is a quote, huffing paint, smoking tons of pot, we were all on speed, crystal meth. Jeff talks about rehab, and then he sort of says drugs are, quote, just annoying, a nightmare. So refreshing. Like, they went through it. It was a disaster, and they got through it. And like you said, you show their families in the end, and their houses, and them with their kids. And, you know, they don't live in, like, H.R. Puff and stuff world. They live in this world with wives and kids and stuff. And, you know, that was very reassuring, you know, that they are just, they're still themselves, but they are living in this world. Were there things that they did not want to discuss or needed to be prodded or had to be convinced would make good film?
Well, I mean, you can see, you know, the the line you didn't quote just now is Jeff when I was asking about drugs, and he says that it just bores the F out of me when I asked him about drugs. He didn't want to talk about it. There's another point that is in the film where I'm pressing him on it, which is an uncomfortable thing. Like, I sort of said to him, I was like, look, I don't think the drug stuff is the most interesting part of your story, but it is a part of your story. I'm making this film. I made it very clear to them up front, like, you guys don't get any kind of final cut or say, like, you just have to trust me. I love your band, but I'm going to tell the story. And, you know, Jeff was very evasive, and he switches into third person when he's talking about it. You know, he just sort of says, like, it's what happens to, you know, show business kids. Things get out of control and they go to rehab, and it's none of it's first person. And actually, this isn't in there, but he starts going on this tangent about death rock and how Los Angeles really started the goth movement. He's talking about 45 Grave and whatever. And it's, I was just like, what are you talking about? Like, I'm asking you questions about your drug use. And he was that reluctant to talk about it. And I pressed him, you know, to an extent, and that material is in there. It's not like a behind the music where I've made it, you know, it's just like the tragic story of, I didn't want to dwell on it, but I felt like I couldn't leave it out. But yeah, I just think it definitely was a part of their story. But when you look at the full trajectory of the band, I don't think it is a defining factor. And this story doesn't have like a lot of rock and roll stories, but the tragic drug ending. The fact is, there's no logical sort of ending moment for this movie. The band's on tour. They're probably playing tonight in Spain. So it had to, like, really, I didn't have that convenient dramatic structure that a lot of these movies have. And so to me, instead, it's just sort of like, hey, this is what a rock and roll success story looks like. It doesn't necessarily mean, that doesn't mean like number one albums and, you know, fame and fortune, but it means following your muse and staying together and keeping at it and continuing to find joy in it, but also just like having a stable life and figuring out this relationship between these two brothers. Like, it's not like always smooth sailing, but it's grown more functional over the years, where they used to like have fist fights on stage. And so there's none of that. And I'm like, this is what success can look like, you know, for a band. And it doesn't, you know, not every documentary has to be like, and then so-and-so drowns in the pool, you know?
Yeah. Well, they're very endearing, and their parents are shown throughout the film, and they're just the most normal, sweet little people, you know, who I won't say they didn't know what to make of their kids, but they did the best they could, you know, but Steve and Jeff are just such unique people. But I think, just to get back to the drugs, I just want to commend you, because by putting all of that in, it sort of lends credence to your storytelling and to their version of events. Okay, you can believe that they're telling the truth here, because they're talking about things that don't reflect, you know, completely rosy, and so it lets you buy their version of events. So congratulations. So let's just to end up, you sort of mentioned you love the band. Just tell me a little bit more about your connection to the band and why you were drawn to spend years of your life making Born Innocent the Red Cross story.
Well, if I had known how long it would take when I got into it, maybe I wouldn't have, but I'm from Morristown, New Jersey. And sort of typical thing, where I had a cool older sister who had the first Ramones record and the first Clash record and the first Sex Pistols record. And I snuck into her room and put those on and fell in love and quickly sort of got into the hardcore scene. And Pat Duncan from FMU was a big part of that. I would just, you know, listen to his show religiously. And there was another, like one other, maybe two other punk kids in my school. One of them was this guy, Dan Macda. I think maybe DJed at FMU for a bit. And
yes,
still in the music. Dan X. And we, you know, as we're both just so getting so into this music, we're like, hey, if we get our FCC licenses, we can get, you know, DJ slots on the high school WJSV, our Morristown High radio station. And then we can probably get free records. We can like write on the WJSB letterhead, to all the independent labels whose addresses we find in Maximum Rock and Roll and Flipside, and we'll get free records, and we can, you know, play them on these shows. And, you know, there are very few radio shows that were playing this kind of music in like 84 when we were doing this, 83, 84. So we did that, and we wrote to all these labels, and one of them was this label, Gasatanka Records, and they sent a package, and in that package was the Teen Babes from Monsanto EP by Red Cross, who it was a band I was sort of aware of, but maybe knew just Annette's Got the Hits from their first record. And that record, which is an album of cover songs of Kiss and David Bowie and Rolling Stones and the Shangri-Las and a Boyce and Hart song from Bewitched, just really blew my mind. There was just, it just was a very mind expanding record for a kid who was really just listening to Adrenaline OD and Agnostic Front and the Bad Brains and just very kind of hardcore kid. I was just like, this is so great. It's heavy, but it's melodic, and it just seems like it's mysterious and it's cool. And I don't know these songs, and maybe I should like give some of these bands a try and not just have this like exclusive diet of thrash, you know. And I just loved it. There was just something about it. And so that's when I became a fan, you know, when I heard that record in 84. And then every record afterwards, I was in college and Neurotica came out. It was just like, this is just the perfect record. It says everything I want to hear. I just loved it so much. And then I moved out to LA in 1990. And that was when, in the 90s, was when I finally got to see them and see them. You know, I think probably Phase Shifter, which is another just, you know, it's a totally different thing, but it's so great. And they were always so much fun live. And so I, you know, any chance I could get, I would see them. And, you know, you have your iTunes list on shuffle, and like, it's just a band where, oh, a Red Cross song comes on and just puts me in a good mood. And I just love them in a unique way among all the many bands that I love. So when I heard Steve tell that incredible story and started thinking like someone should make this documentary, I did have a friend, a mutual friend, who was like, could you introduce me to them and let me make my pitch to them as someone who's never made a movie, as you know, never made a documentary, but I am, you know, I'm a television writer, television comedy writer with, you know, 25 years of experience writing. And hopefully I can just convince them that I could tell, you know, do a good job of telling their story. And they did, you know, they took the chance on me, even though I didn't have a track record to point to. I think they got that I really was a true fan and knew a lot about all of the sort of musical worlds that they had been in, and said, okay, you know, we trust you, let's do this. And then I just had to, you know, figure out how you make a documentary, which just like
that's all
turned out to be.
Well, and thank goodness your wife dared you to make it.
I know.
Yeah. Born Innocent, the Red Cross story. Folks can go to redcrossfilm.com and watch your spelling on that. They can come to Monty Hall December 22nd and see the movie and streaming eventually near you. But check that website, because I know you're adding places where it's going to show in person.
Yeah. And two D's and a K. Don't forget, two D's and a K. It still gets misspelled about 50% of the time.
I'm sure it does. Anyway, congratulations, Andrew. Thank you so much. Like I said, I just really enjoyed the film, and I hope lots of folks go out and see it.
All right. Thank you so much, Michael. This is great. I appreciate you doing it.